Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 80 at the very beginning, which is old single column page 889. Okay, so we finally made it through the paper outlining the relationship of the Andites to the Orient. So now it's obviously time for the Occident. So we go from east to west, and similar to what we saw before, we could get to dealing with Yellow Man in the Far East directly and the Andites coming in to engage them. We have to set the stage. We need to drop back a bit and make sure that it's properly laid out what you have for an evolutionary human context in Europe before the Andites show up. And unlike with going to the east, you actually have, because of the immediate proximity, you have some direct engagement from the Adamites to a degree that produces a significant consequence, long before you're talking about Andites precisely getting to Europe. So this setting the stage before we get to the Andites directly, isn't just going to be about the Sangiks like we saw with like Red Man and Yellow Man fighting each other for 200,000 years in the far east and that sort of story. You have the Adamites coming in almost immediately. Post default. So let's get into it here. I don't think there's much else we need to say. Other little intro things we can speak of and give us these two little opening paragraphs in the preface here, I think. So go ahead.
Paper 80, Andite Expansion in the Occident. Although the European blue man did not of himself achieve a great cultural civilization, he did supply the biologic foundation which, when its Adamite strains were blended with the later Andite invaders, produced one of the most potent stocks for the attainment of aggressive civilization ever to appear on Urantia since the times of the Violet Race and their Andite successors.
Okay, so obviously one of the first things they want to remind us of, if it's not obvious to everyone, of course, we're setting the stage for Western civilization. And, the one little comment they also put in there, let's make sure we understand what the deal is there. When they say that although the European blue man did not of himself achieve a great cultural civilization, remember they made a point that both Red Man and Yellow Man did get a degree of civilization going without Adamic uplift, to any great degree. But even there, the only reason that they had some tendency to get going on their own without a lot of genetic foundation for civilization from the Adamic uplift is the influence of the Prince's staff on Red Man and Yellow Man, teaching them some of the basic ways of civilization, and they carried that eastward when they left Central Asia. Okay, and so the pump was primed by the Prince's staff and the primary Sangic took it forward just in and of themselves as much as you can as a Sangic. Blue Man certainly could have done the same thing. But there's a couple of issues. One, he was very, because of the closeness to the rebellion 200,000 years ago, he was very severely impacted by the rebellion. So that had kind of short-circuited that priming of the pump by the prince's staff for them to be civilized. You had this sort of decivilizing, disrupting influence from the rebellion that hit them very definitively. And then on top of that, you know, as we've talked about many times, they head over to Europe. And I remember we were having Red Man and Yellow Man meeting each other and getting the war going about 300,000 years ago. And we mentioned at the time, you know, a similar meeting, big meeting was happening in Europe about 300,000 years ago is when Blue Man, you know, basically pure Blue Man, maybe a little red and yellow mixed in as he's heading that way, but basically pure Blue Man, meets Neanderthal peoples in Europe. And you remember I reminded you that you had what those more ancient peoples that current scientists don't call Neanderthals, they're going to call them Homo erectus or various Homo erectus-like creatures, you know, in Europe, that, you know, that are slowly being degraded from 850,000 years ago because of backmating with subhuman, you know, biologically compatible strains. And so remember how I remind you that they said that starting 550,000 years ago and for 250,000 years, so in other words, until 300,000 years ago, it was steadily declining, the culture there in that Neanderthal culture, becoming more and more backgraded and degraded. And then in 300,000 years ago, in comes Blue Man. And Blue Man begins to mate with the better strains, and he, you know, he either exterminates or marginalizes the lesser strains. And you get this upstepping of the Neanderthal stock. And it's that Blue Man upstepped Neanderthal stock that current scientists call Neanderthal man. Okay. So, you know, it's a hodgepodge andonic stock. You know, there's all these other strains blended in from the back mating, but it's kind of a curious andonic-like stock with some Blue Man upstepping it that gives us what scientists call Neanderthal man. And so you in Europe, and back to the point here, that first sentence, you don't have the kind of primary Sangic in Europe that you did out there in Asia. You have a primary Sangic that's been modified, you know, in many ways, at least initially in their actualization, degraded. There's some positive potentials that some of that non-human stock brought in. That can get activated when atomites come in there. But prior to that, you have a dampened primary Sangic there in Europe. So they're not leaning into civilization as much. Genetically, so nature is not quite there like it was with the Red Man and Yellow Man in Asia. And the nurture thing, like I said, is also a big issue. They were very severely impacted by the rebellion because of the closeness. Okay. So that's why they're kind of languishing there. And then, let's see, everything else there? And then, like I said, we're about to read extensively about, you can see it, them saying there, something we hadn't quite seen before, when they say, when its atomized strains, see, were blended with the later Andite invaders. Like I said, we're going to, see, we first boosted this with Blue Man, and then we're going to boost it again with a little bit of direct Adamic stock. And so it's going to be, a yet further modified, quote-unquote, Blue Man. You know, and then it's that very complicated stock that gets loads and loads and loads and loads of Andites brought in, like we've read, you know, the majority of the Andites going in there to produce, you know, in particular, the northern white race. You know, the central white race, the southern white race there's complexities, further complexities to them that we'll read about. But anyway, that's the deal. So you can see it's a much more complicated situation genetically that we have to consider when we're talking about Europe than what we're talking about in Asia. Because remember, in Asia, there was almost no tendency for any backmating going on, because a lot of those strains were just not that attractive. Right, we're either exterminated or very much marginalized. Remember that. So, it's a very, very complicated story here in Europe. But it ends up being, you know, if you get enough Adamic uplift, despite the all of these complexities and, well, like I said, what in the near term can be a degradation, you might say, but nonetheless, you can kind of power up through all of the negativity and actualize some potentials that you're just not going to have on almost any other planet. Right? I mean, this is going to be a very relatively unique kind of stock that's going to get uplifted by the Adamic stock here in Europe. It's going to produce cultural phenomena that would be quite different than the run-of-the-mill world. Okay, but at the same time, as we'll see as we read forward, we'll see some clear signs that there's some dominant Blue Man in the stock because of some of their basic tendencies, you know, like we saw with Red Man and Yellow Man and which adjutant they favor. Okay, let's get a little bit more here.
The modern white peoples incorporate the surviving strains of the Adamic stock, which became admixed with the Sangreen races. Some red and yellow, but more especially the blue. There is considerable percentage of the original Andinite stock in all the white races, and still more of the early Nodite strains.
Nodites.
Nodites.
All right, so their little reminder at the end, you know, is that additional complexity. Again, the closeness of the Nodites. So for 200,000 years, right, you have them feeding into Europe as well. Okay, so it's this very complicated setup. And the degree to which Nodites are kind of quasi Adamic genetically, right? You have kind of some quasi Adamic infusion there too. That atomized, you know, you can kind of add that to the atomized aspect of their nature. Let's see. And there's, again, like I said, remember, there's a little red and a little yellow. They mentioned that several times. That before Blue Man, you know, goes definitively west from Central Asia, there's a little bit of blending amongst the primary Sangiks in Central Asia there. So there's a little red and a little yellow that goes with them over to Europe, and that's why, you know, as I've said many times, you know, I'm basically, without a lot of pigment in my skin from Northern Europe, but if I carefully tan myself, I don't get that, you know, brownish from the andonite pigment as much as I get red. Right? I obviously have a significant amount of red man in my, because I tan very, very red, like a red man does. When exposed to the sun, they're, you know, they're, remember the, you know, the deal with, you know, with the Sanghic colors. Yeah. Right. And, you know, it looks like I'm burnt, but I'm not, you know, even, you know, I obviously burn very easily. So, in order to do this, I have to be very careful. I have to do it in small doses. But if I do it carefully, I can actually build up a tan, you know, and it'll look like I'm sunburned, but it's not. It's just, you know, the only pigment I seem to have is red man pigment. Right. And so it actually goes the way, way, way back that red man got into northern Europe there. You know, and some northern Europeans, you know, especially if I put my, you know, look at each other, well, we both apparently have white skin, quote unquote, and then you put the skin there, it's like, oh, yours looks kind of reddish, actually. Oh, and yours looks kind of yellowish, yeah. See, you know, you'll find a northern European person that has a lot, you know, you can see that yellow man pigment coming out in their skin. You know, it's all washed down to this white-like, you know, diluted, all the colors are so diluted because there's so much andite that went into, you know, especially northern Europe, the colors are washed way down, okay? But nonetheless, you know, it's definitely there. It's not, you know, they're not jaundiced. No, they have a little yellow man pigment, right, in their skin. Yep. Yep. Do you have some?
Well, so I'm thinking, you know, you were mentioning about a normal world. So there probably isn't a white race on normal worlds.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, no. I mean, when there's, you know, when there's not a rebellion and a default, right, you know, there, you have, you know, a lot more pigment to the blended people.
Because they eventually end up being like an olive green.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got all six, of course, you know, so you have Green Man bringing in that. Yeah, but if you have a world that just has the primaries, the three primaries, even so, it's going to be, you know, a more pigmented final, But if you take blue, mix in a little red and a little yellow, so you kind of, it's kind of, you know, kind of a brown, and then you heavily dilute it with, you know, Adamic, that's how you get the white. okay. All right, I guess we got everything there. Okay, so that's the basic. You know, they just want to remind you we're heading towards Western civilization, why there's Western civilization, answering that genetically. And it's a complicated story genetically. Okay, well, what about these Adamites trickling, you know, just a hop, skip, and a jump from Mesopotamia over there into Europe? How does that happen?
Section 1, the Adamites enter Europe. Before the last Andites were driven out of the Euphrates Valley, many of their brethren had entered Europe as adventurers, teachers, traders, and warriors. During the earlier days of the Violet Race, the Mediterranean trough was protected by the Gibraltar Isthmus and the Sicilian Land Bridge. Some of man's very early maritime commerce was established on these inland lakes, where blue men from the north and the Saharans from the south met the Nautites and Adamites from the east.
Okay, see, so that's the deal, how it gets started, you know, very, very early on. You've got a very different geography than you have now. Remember, so here we are, this is coming up again. This has come up a couple times before. You have this very unbeknownst to current scientists, you had the Strait of Gibraltar sealed this recent. Okay?
What are they talking about here?
Yeah, well, I'll get to the specific in a second. But the scientists think that the last time the Strait of Gibraltar was closed was over 5 million years ago. You know, way before the Ice Age, you know, even the extended, you know, length of the Ice Ages that the Revelation brings out. know, and they think it's been open ever since. You know, no. I mean, it was, remember how this worked, that there was almost 4,000 years from the time that Adam and Eve left the first garden until the first garden went under because of this, right? Because of the Atlantic coming through and filling up the western trough of the Mediterranean, and then in short order, breaching the Sicilian land bridge and filling up the eastern trough. And all the tectonic activity and whatnot, and the, you know, that little tiny peninsula goes completely down under the water there in the eastern Mediterranean.
Instead of 75,000 people die, right?
Well, we're going to get to a thing where, you know, talking about that. You know, it's in this context that they're going to give us a little bit more details about that than they have before. They've just hinted at it before. But they gave us the timing before, back when they're talking about the first garden sinking. I mean, it's basically about 34,000 years ago, right? About 32,000 BC. Now, 34,000 years ago is when this happened, this incredible flood. That's a little bit more recent than over 5 million years ago, okay? And, you know, the thing that you have to keep in mind is it's the Mediterranean. I mean, if you were to seal up, like if you were to put a dam across the Strait of Gibraltar, say you wanted to generate, you know, hydroelectric power, putting a dam across there, you know, you'd evaporate the Mediterranean in about 1,000 years. So, you know, it seems like this incredible, you know, body of water, but I mean, things are, you know, things can change quickly, right? I mean, 1,000 years is nothing in geologic terms, and that's very quickly. You can have radical changes. We, like I've said so many times, humans have this very distorted concept of the climate and the geology of the planet because things have been so relatively calm for 8,000 years now, you know, or at least 7,000 years, you know, from, you know, that 6,000 to 5,000 BC range is, you know, is when the climate settled down so that coincidentally, right, you know, we all know it's not a coincidence at all, climate settles down for a while so that humans can get civilization established and can handle change, you know, of significance. Don't be surprised if the climate starts changing again, right? It's always changed radically throughout all of human, you know, all of the Earth's history, yeah.
I'm a little puzzled by their description of these inland lakes, right, which makes me think they were fresh water.
No. I mean, just because it's an inland lake doesn't mean it's fresh water. And the Caspian Sea is an inland lake. It's not fresh water. Right? No. I mean, even now, the Mediterranean is saltier than the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, it's a like I said, I mean, think about that. How, you know, in 1,000 years, you could dry the thing up, basically, you know, and just have two little lakes down at the bottom again. You know, obviously, you know, it's going to be higher salinity with that kind of evaporation. And so you have that you know, denser, more saline water flowing underneath and out into the Atlantic Ocean, and the fresher, you know, the less saline Atlantic water flowing in the top. You know, they cross each other vertically like that, you know, in the Strait of Gibraltar. Yeah. So, yeah, but you just picture a couple of really big lakes, you know, way down in the, you know, in the bottom of those two big basins. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple great lakes, quote unquote, yeah, down there in the bottom of those two basins. And a great big land bridge, you know, between Africa and Italy, of course, you know, I mean, there's no separation between Italy and Sicily, you know, it's all just one great big bridge of land there, you know, between Europe and Africa. So, see, it's easy for them to go back and forth, you know, from between Europe and Africa because of the Sicilian land bridge. And you have all this wonderful area that's not there anymore, land, for civilization to exist as maritime civilization around those two big lakes. Okay, so that's the deal. And you have all this commerce going on. We'll get more about the details here in a second. They're just teasing us with this. But again, you know, so just to remind you before we read on that all this is all this comes to an end 34,000 years ago. But for almost 4,000 years, you have this very easy location for Adamites. You know, you're leveraging off of that Mediterranean region for the Adamites to be feeding into Europe a bit for almost 4,000 years. Okay, so that's, obviously that's going to get short-circuited once it fills up and things are blocked and whatnot. But for, way back at the very beginning, post-default, you're going to have Adamites getting into Europe.
So the first garden actually extended into a lake, not into the Mediterranean.
Right. Yeah, remember, there's all of these things that have radically changed. There's been huge elevation changes and stuff. So, you can't just think of it like it is now.
I understand.
It extended into a lake, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And extended into that eastern basin lake. And remember how, eventually, the eastern one, eventually there's enough glacial melt and the oceans continue to rise. And finally the Mediterranean, flows back up the Bosphorus and fills in the Black Sea too. And that happened, the final kind of big changes were happening in the 6,000 to 5,000 BC range. But by 5,000 BC, it's very much like it is today, and we all think, well, this is the way it's always been. It's like, no, this is a very short time it's been like this. Very different. You have to think in long, when you start talking about tens of thousands of years or even hundreds of thousands of years, there can be a lot of movement of land vertically. Okay, we think of everything as just sitting there put. If anything, it's just slowly being ground down by erosion or something. It's like, no, stuff is moving vertically, tectonic activity and whatnot. So there's a lot of changes that occurred. Let's keep going here.
In the eastern trough of the Mediterranean, the Nadites had established one of their most extensive cultures, and from these centers had penetrated somewhat into southern Europe, but more especially into northern Africa. The broad-headed Nadite, Andinite, Syrians very early introduced pottery and agriculture in connection with their settlements on the slowly rising Nile Delta. They also imported sheep, goat, cattle, and other domesticated animals and brought in greatly improved methods of metalworking, Syria then being the center of that industry.
So there we are again, totally unbeknownst to the archaeologists that way back there, in what they think is nothing but Stone Age stuff is all of this Nadite and Adamite influence giving metalworking long, long, long before the Bronze Age, and certainly a long time before the Iron Age. The Bronze Age is about 3,500 BC, and the Iron Age is about 1,000 BC. We're talking, 35,000 BC. Right?
Iron for us.
All right. Way back. And you had Syria being, like you're saying, being a center for metalworking industry, Okay. The one thing you notice again that we're heading towards the concepts that you get in Western civilization, including the perversions of it by the Nazis and stuff. You start talking about long-headed, broad-headed issues. Eventually they'll get to laying that out, how the different races, humans have spent a lot of time thinking about those sorts of things. They address that. And it's the Andenites that are broadheaded. So that original stock is broadheaded. The Adamites are longheaded. And even though the prince's staff started out with Andonic stock, well, after 300,000 years, they had mutated into something, like I said a little bit ago, is quasi-Adamic in genetically. And so by the time of the rebellion, they're long-headed. And just that little tidbit, it reminds you of how potentially controversial some of the stuff in the book is. So anyone that knows, how the Nazis were fixated on running around the world with calipers and, and measuring people's skull diameters, looking for the master race. You start saying things like that and they burn you at the stake now. But to just throw in that thing, all you have to do is be, if you start with your evolutionary broadheadedness, the original stock, you expose it to supposedly the energies of heaven, quote unquote, and it becomes long-headed. I mean, that is just ripe for, if someone wanted to go off on a perverted tangent, they've got a lot more to work with in the Urantia book than what the Nazis did from the beginning of the 20th century.
What kind of headman are they looking for?
Long-headed. They're looking for long-headed people. They're looking for, because they're looking for Andite, blood. They didn't know that's what they were doing, but, that's basically what they're doing. They're looking for locations in the world that were influenced by Andite blood. Okay, so you've got, you mix Dodites in with the Andenites, and the broadheadedness comes back again. See, that's a, Nodite hyphen Andenite, you got an Andenite foundation, you're adding a little bit of Nodite on top of it, the broadheadedness is coming back again. And think about the Nile, of course, is flowing way down into the lake, how much sediment is built up in the Nile Valley now, and how much the Nile Delta has changed over time. Okay, but see, they're pointing out that it's especially that eastern trough, obviously, because it's so close to Mesopotamia, that just provides a very natural location, this wonderful location for Adamites to begin to feed into Europe, and have all of the civilization that the Nodites started before the Adamites were around. Like they're saying, that's going on there, a full commerce and the primitive arts of civilization. All right, let's keep going here.
For more than 30,000 years, Egypt received a steady stream of Mesopotamians who brought along their art and culture to enrich that of the Nile Valley. But the ingress of large numbers of the Sahara peoples greatly deteriorated the early civilization along the Nile, so that Egypt reached its lowest cultural level some 15,000 years ago.
Okay, so see a little bit of a side note there about Egypt that they throw in. You're going to have all of this genetic uplift being fed into the Nile Valley region there. But obviously, they're going to tell us about that in a little bit here. Obviously, when it starts to turn into desert there in the Sahara, post-glacial age, it's going to drive the peoples of that civilization out of that area, and that's what they're referring to there. Some of them are going to go in. And so, since recorded history begins about 6,000 B.C., right, you see, some 15,000 years ago, as they're saying, it's way down at this low level, right? It appears to us that, what civilization you have in Egypt just kind of comes out of, a background of basically no civilization. You know, little knowing that, no, if you go back, you know, that wasn't the you know, the constant floor that existed before that. That was like the waves in the glacier age, you know, where you have maxima and minima. You know, that was a cultural minimum, right? And then more Sumerian influence came in and pulled it back up out of the minimum again. I mean, there's a number of things we have illusions like that. We don't know that there was at least former highs, or there's a cycle going back. We, you know, like with the expansion of the universe, right? We see it expanding right now, so we extrapolate back and think, well, it started at a point and it's just been expanding out from that. You know, no concept that no, yeah, it respirates. You know, and you just have to be watching it right now on one of its outward cycles, and it never collapses to zero. It doesn't expand and collapse in that. You know, sense it respirates, it breathes. Right, there's an equilibrium dimension. Right,
long breath.
Right. So anyway, just to remind you of just how many situations you have where we see a trend and we assume basically a linear or a monotonic sort of phenomenon, right? I mean, you know, and of course you probably should assume the simplest thing like that to begin with, but, you know, often that's a very poor assumption because it's a lot more complicated than that. Anyway, okay, back to the doings here. So, you know, and remember that, as I pointed out, when you think about not just a more sophisticated culture in this area, but, you know, even a little bit more sophisticated genetics, when the archaeologists are digging up things, you know, they'll find stuff that seems to have a little bit of an advanced nature. And you go, well, wait a minute, that's before Adam and Eve. That can't be. Their date must be off. It's like, well, no, don't forget. I mean, there's Nodites, right? The Nodites can take some of that in a, you know, more sophisticated, say, skull structure, you know, phenomenon back further. So, in the areas where you have Nodites going all the way back to 200,000 years ago, you know, they stayed, you know, they didn't go far, you know, but in that immediate region, you know, you could get some things where it might appear that you had Adamic uplift. It's like, you know, no, that was sort of Nodite uplifty of the peoples there a little bit before. Okay, all right. Now, kind of back to the Adamites here.
But during earlier times, there was little to hinder the westward migration of the Adamites. The Sahara was an open grazing land overspread by herders and agriculturists. These Saharans never engaged in manufacture, nor were they city builders. They were an indigo black group which carried extensive strains of the extinct green and orange races. But they received a very limited amount of the violet inheritance before the upthrust of land and the shifting water-laden winds dispersed the remnants of this prosperous and peaceful civilization.
Okay, and we're just, like I was saying, they're going to get dispersed. And notice they're, you know, pointing out how much upthrust of land, you know, changing the geography is involved in this too, besides the flooding and the changing of the winds and stuff. Okay, but so when they say, but during earlier times, so like I said, you have, you know, this, you know, less than 4,000 years, we'll say 3,500 years or something, of time where you had Adamites blending in. You know, so almost 4,000 years, you've got some Adamites feeding into Europe, and modifying this complicated quote-unquote blue man stock there. That atomization, as they were saying in the opening paragraph. Okay, and let's see what else we have there. Oh yeah, then okay. So a little bit reminding you about, and they've mentioned this before. What kind of these the Saharan civilization, these so-called Saharan peoples? What do you have there? Remember, first orange man headed headed to the west from Central Asia, and then blue man went in there. And the orange man that he didn't kill off, did I say green man?
You said blue man.
Oh, not blue man. It just occurred to me. I think green man. Okay, first orange man went in there. It's funny how you go down the roadways and suddenly it's like, wait a minute, I think you said the wrong thing. Okay, so first orange man went in there, and then green man came from Central Asia, and the orange man that he didn't kill off, he blended with, and then Indigo Man, third in line. So all the secondary Sangiks are all kind of going that same direction to the southwest there from Central Asia. So, and then Indigo Man comes in and, kills off a lot of the Green Man and the ones he doesn't blends in with. And so to begin with there, you have all three primary Sangiks blended together. I said primary. Wow. Okay. All three secondary Sangiks blended together. You have to focus here. All three secondary Sangiks blended together. So you get very, very dark brown man. You get black man. Okay. But then there's lots and lots of Indigo man that continue to stream in. Right, and so just like that, they don't say black hyphen indigo, right? They say indigo hyphen black. You have that black foundation, the three secondary Sangiks blended together, topped off by a lot of Indigo man. Okay. All right, so those are the peoples that you have there in northern Africa, genetically. And then they'll give us more details about how they get dispersed when the water-laden winds shift here in a little bit here, and they talk about that. But you had this, because you had that genetic balance with all three secondary Sangiks as a foundation, it produced, like they're saying there, a prosperous and peaceful civilization as a sort of foundational balance. They've already done mass extermination of one, and they've kind of gotten that out of their system, right? And settled into this, for a long, long, long time, they have this civilization there in northern Africa. Okay. All right, let's keep going here.
Adam's blood has been shared with most of the human races, but some secured more than others. The mixed races of India and the darker peoples of Africa were not attractive to the Adamites. They would have mixed freely with the red man had he not been far removed in the Americas, and they were kindly disposed towards the yellow man, but he was likewise difficult of access in faraway Asia. Therefore, when actuated by either adventure or altruism, or when driven out of the Euphrates Valley, they very naturally chose union with the blue races of Europe.
Okay, so there you have it, why it was that very early on, you had them feeding in with the blue. Again, like I said, it's just a geographic issue. And they're closer, and then on top of that, the space between them, is a very pleasant domain for them to just drift into around the eastern basin of the Mediterranean. There, yep, you got some.
I just wanted to know if you could give a little bit of background about the Sangic races. We brought three. Very curious.
Okay.
People have been reading the Rancho book about 3 days.
About 3 days. Okay. Yeah, well, you're jumping kind of into the deep end here, but fortunately tonight it isn't hyper deep. Okay, so You had an original evolutionary stock that come from the first two humans called Andon and Fonta. Because of that, those humans are called Andonites. And you go forward for 500,000 years, and then out of that initial evolutionary will creature, human stock, you get six different variations are born. Very curiously on this world, all within one family. You get this mutation, if you will. They look basically the same in many ways, but there's differences. For instance, eventually we'll get to this whole broad-headed, long-headed thing, medium-headed. Okay, there's some variations amongst these six different flavors, but the biggie difference is when these children, spend some time in the sun, they started to tan instead of having just the melanin that we all have in common, because we all harken back to that pigment that's in that original Andonite stock. They tanned red, orange, yellow, green, and indigo. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and indigo. Six different skin colorings, when they tanned. It literally breaks up into the primary colors and the secondary colors. Red, yellow, blue, the primary colors, are the primary sangics. They're called, the relatives coined the term sangic for them. That literally means bloodline producing. Humans have always recognized there's sort of bloodlines. There's race, there's ethnicities, there's strains. That harkens in many ways on every world. Every world has these sangics, has these bloodline producing differences. You've got three primaries, like the three primary colors, red, yellow, blue. And three secondary sangics, secondary colors, orange, green, indigo. The similarity amongst the secondary sangics and kind of their basic features, when all is said and done with all the different blending that happened on this planet in kind of a chaotic fashion because of the default, there's this commonality amongst those secondary sangics is what we recognize as negroid. The features, negroid-like features. So set skin color aside and just think features, negroid features, and you have a commonality amongst the secondary sangics, and then just think of them being not black or brown or something like that, but thinking of being orange, green, and indigo. Right. And even today, right, I mean, if people were more discerning, right, if you look closely, especially if you get bright sunlight on someone with dark skin, I go, oh, well, now actually I look closely, that isn't a black person, is it? Their skin is quite indigo, right? There's a lot of people that have a significant indigo hue to their actual pigment. It's also fairly easy to find when you look, instead of just saying, oh, it's a black man. It's like, no, that's not a black man. Look at them. They're orange. Right? There's a number of people, like, say, in northern Africa, as you can find. They're very, very orange. They have that basic negroid features, but they're quite orange-skinned. And then if you look, it's a little more difficult to find. But you can find very rarely in Africa, and a little more commonly in India, get some bright sunlight on them and go, whoa, that's not a black man. Their skin is green. Right? And it's because of green men. You know, they have a significant amount of green men in their blend, and so their skin is green. You know, and this is, and it's not subtle. I mean, it's very definitive, these colors. You know, if you just start looking, I mean, once you start looking, it's, you know, you won't think about the races like you have, you know, before ever again. And so and we'll see in a little bit, you know, why do we call people in Southern Europe, some people in Southern Europe, olive-skinned? Right? Is that some sort of a weird poetic designation? No, it's because they have a little bit of green man in them from the Saharan civilization here, and so their skin has a little bit of an olive tone to it. And you heard me kind of explain what happens there when you mix the secondaries, and then with the primaries, I mean, it's not some sort of a curious thing. I mean, red man is red man, yellow man is yellow man.
Blue man doesn't exist.
And blue man basically, is totally awash, like we've described here, in all this in Europe. There's some blending into, you know, what now we might call yellow man or red man. They aren't as yellow man or red man as they once were. There really aren't any pure races anymore. There's been lots of blending. But nonetheless, you go back 500,000 years ago, and you had pure races. And it was just a handful of each of these colored children. But when that skin pigment's dominant. And so when they've mated with the basic previous Andonite stock, the children had their skin pigment. Yeah, so that skin pigment is dominant. So, you know, eventually you have a whole red race, and you have a whole yellow race, a whole blue race, a whole orange race, a whole green race, a whole indigo race.
I had one thing also. Yep. This is all part of the plan. It's not
It's
all part of the plan of the life carriers who maybe you could.
On a normal world, way back in ancient times, you know, relative to the evolution of civilization, and Adam and Eve comes to every world, and they're not just there to produce a whole bunch of progeny which then blend in with the evolutionary stocks and uplift the evolutionary stock genetically, but they're also there, that Adam and Eve are there to manage the blending of the evolutionary stocks. So like on our world, if they hadn't defaulted, if they'd gone through, it takes 25,000 years for them to kind of work their plan. So in other words, at about 10,000 BC on this planet, if they had gone through, we would have just one race on this planet. They would have blended all of the secondary and primary Zangic stock all together into one race. They know how to blend it so that you get the proper balance. That would have all been managed, but there's been no management. You know, there's been kind of haphazard blending, like they've already mentioned. You've got basic kind of preferences. Oh, I'm sexually attracted to you, but not you. You know, we've just had these sort of natural things happening. Who's located where? You know, if you put two people in the same room for long enough, they start to become sexually attracted to one another. That's just the way it works with mankind. So races that are located nearby, just over time, even if they aren't initially inclined to mate, will start to mate, you know, and they'll start to blend. But all of that was supposed to be managed. And so there was supposed to be one race about 12,000 years ago. And that one race would have been significantly uplifted. We got very little uplifting. By 10,000 BC, we would have been an extremely advanced, genetic, unified race. And they would have, over those 25,000 years, they also would have given us full ultimatonic level science. We would have had technology, you know, beyond your wildest imaginations by 10,000 BC if everything had gone well. That's what they normally would do. Okay, so that's a little thumbnail sketch of what we're talking about here. But instead, it all kind of happened haphazardly, and there was a default, but there still ended up being some Adamic stock, and we're talking about it, you know, migrating various places and blending in.
Chris,
yep.
Do you want to say what you mean when you say the default?
Oh, Adam. Without going into the details, Adam and Eve. Our Adam and Eve got sidetracked, thinking there was a way, because there was a rebellion 200,000 years ago on this planet of the planetary administration, things were kind of chaotic here, and it was going to be very complicated to do their normal work, and so they had an idea of how to short-circuit the time it was going to take on this complicated world. They departed from the established plan of how to do this properly, and so that put them in default. They were unplugged from the energies that allow them to be immortal and go on and, you know, produce children for, you know, thousands and thousands of tens of thousands of years and whatnot, and you know, they became immortal. They became mortal and died off in short order, but tried to leave behind enough progeny that they could, you know, before they died off. So that's what the default is them going from the ordained plan of how to properly upstep and blend the races on this world. All right, let's see, now back to, where were we here? Okay, let's see, yeah, so we were talking about, you know, like we talked about, they're a very complicated mix and a lot of secondary Sangic in India. Yeah, even from the very beginning, there wasn't much sexual attraction there, so there was limited Adamic infusion into some of those peoples, and then the red man and the yellow man being geographically remote, so Blue Man and his complexities got a lot of immediate attention in Europe. And notice it isn't just kind of just the natural thing, like I was saying, of sexual attraction that might come into play with adventure. You go adventurous, you often find some fancy female, and everything does it. It happens naturally. You know, there's altruism in there, notice they threw in. You know, we talked about how even, you know, thousands and thousands of years when you don't have pure Adamites anymore and you have Andites, they still very much are trying to hold on to that basic part of Adam and Eve's plan on every world to see themselves as altruistic bestowals to a world biologically, right? To see themselves as biologic uplifters, you know, and to overlook, you know, basic animal level sexual attractive issues, right? And mate for the greater good, you know, as we tend to say. So, you know, that was going on, you know, even way, way back. All right, let's keep going.
The Blue Men, then dominant in Europe, had no religious practices which were repulsive to the earlier migrating Adamites, and there was great sex attraction between the violet and the blue races. The best of the Blue Men deemed it a high honor to be permitted to mate with the Adamites. Every Blue Man entertained the ambition of becoming so skillful and artistic as to win the affection of some Adamite woman, and it was the highest aspiration of a superior blue woman to receive the attentions of an Adamite.
Okay, so there definitely was a basic sexual attraction there, going both directions. Yeah. Yeah, and for those of you who are just jumping into the deep end here, when they say violet race, that's not a skin color now. The children of Adam and Eve and their, you know, descendants They're called the violet race. You know, they basically have, you know, just very, very fair skin. It's not a, they don't have a color. But they're called the violet race because Adam and Eve, normally, when they're plugged into these energies that maintain them immortally, it's a high enough energy input into them that they actually glow a violet hue in the dark. Okay, so it's because of them glowing like that, you know, mom and dad of the whole race, right, that all of the descendants are called the violet race. But they're just, and all of the Sangiks, all of the original Andonites, and all of the Sangiks, all of them have black hair, black eyes, right? Because all they have just that basic nature. You know, all of the non-black hair, black eyes on the planet comes from Adam and Eve's offspring. So blonde or red or brown hair, and non-black eyes.
Where's the gray hair come from?
Where does gray hair come from? That comes from a phenomenon that life animation slowly loses its identification with matter. that's what the violet race is there for the uninitiated that are listening here. Back to the details. So you had this very intense attraction. And remember, we saw that right away. I mean, this blending of these, you know, the immediacy of what was going on with Adam and Eve and their children with the blue race, that started right from the very beginning. Remember back when they, left the first garden after the default and went over to Mesopotamia to found the second garden. And you had not only Cain from Eve and her Nodite mate, but you had Sansa, right, from Adam and his Nodite mate. Leata, remember, her name was Leata. The child, those two was named Sansa. And as soon as Sansa grew up, what does it say that she did, if you remember back there? Sansa grew up to be a woman of great ability, obviously, with her parentage. She became the wife of Sargon, the chief of the northern blue races, right? And contributed to the advancement of the blue men of those times. Okay, so she was the first one, right? Sansa was, so the first one was not Adamite, male to blue female. The first one was Adamite female to blue male, Sansa. Got the whole process started. Notice that, it even said the northern blue races. So, they're not just going to the most southern part of Europe there from Mesopotamia. Some of them are penetrating quite a ways north into Europe. Yeah. Right away from the very beginning. So you have almost 4,000 years, starting with Sansa, of them blending in like that. Okay, and so you're going to end up with a people in Europe, that Adamic blood blended in, that are going to be noticeable archaeologically. Okay? Yep.
They're giving us tons of information here about our racial problems. It's a big mess. So just for the sake of our young readers here,
yep.
Why are they telling us this, and maybe you can help them
understand
like how we're supposed to fix this mess? And why the Iranians?
Right. Well, okay, not to go out forever, the purpose of the fifth epical revelation, this book that's in my lap called the Iranja book, is to give us the full philosophic picture within which we can address all kinds of details. There's lots of improvement in religion that needs to be done. You can't improve religion if you don't have the philosophic context within which to improve religion. Science, especially after, you know, over 100 years now of decay throughout the 20th century into the 21st century, is in desperate need of enlightenment. I mean, science is almost gone now. We have all kinds of technology, but we don't have science anymore. Science is in desperate need of enlightenment. You can't enlighten science if you don't have it in the philosophic context. I mean, science and religion exists within the sphere of philosophy, genuine philosophy, not arbitrary doctrines dreamt up by people. That's not philosophy. Okay. Philosophy isn't studying dead philosophers or their doctrines. The fifth epical revelation is not only a philosophic text in that sense. So the first step is it has to explain to you what philosophy is for the first time. I mean, humans have been trying to figure that out for 2,600 years and haven't been able to figure out what this word is that we use is about. So once you recognize what genuine philosophy is, and you can have that full context, that big picture, you can begin to approach all of the difficult problems this world faces, whether it's problems with government, or problems with race, you know, or problems with fundamental physics, or problems with our ideas about God, or whatever the problem is that you want to address. You can approach it from the top down objectively. Because of the default, like I was saying, race is a mess on this planet. We don't, you know, for the time being, we don't have anyone here to guide us. We don't have an Adam and Eve that can see the big picture, you know, and guide mankind in this way. So we've got to do what we can ourselves right now. They're giving us this for help. We need to approach bringing the races together wisely. But you can't do anything wisely if all you have is some sort of ideals that you're trying to be motivated by. That's just half the picture. In order to get wisdom, you have to face the facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom.
And so how does this guy Jesus fit
in? You say thumbnail in a big way.
Jesus, I mean, just to make it long story short, okay, you just noticed I needed two elements there. I need to be able to objectively engage facts, and I need to genuinely get a hold of ideals. 2,000 years ago, Jesus' role as an incarnate son was as a spiritual uplifter, to not only leave behind a stimulus, but to send the bestowal of the Spirit of Truth and allowing for the universal bestowal of thought adjusters, a spiritual uplifting, so that it's more innate that humans can genuinely recognize spiritual ideals. Humans have long had the notion of ideals, but they apply it to matter. They apply it to what they see. And we have all sorts of false material idealism. You know, thinking that a certain arrangement of molecules is idyllic. Ideals doesn't have anything to do with matter. Ideals has to do with the other substance besides matter. Spirit is another substance in the external world. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. And ideals are about that other substance. Like one of the things Jesus said that, you know, that if you want to think about it in a simple and as appropriate initial way, is that God in heaven that you've heard about, Stop thinking about him as some sort of a kind of material father, an exalted material father. He's not a material father. He's a spiritual father. Think about him as being made out of that other stuff, the stuff you don't trip over, not matter, spirit stuff. He's made out of that. And ideals are tied to that domain. Ideals are not to be found with your eyeballs in the external world. And be found in your genuine inner life. And until you stop questing for ideals in the external world, you'll never actually find the genuine inner life. You'll find things that you call the inner life, but that's not really the inner life. Everyone calls something the inner life that's not. What that is it's their feelings about the outer life. Your feelings about the outer life is not your inner life. Your feelings are of the mind. They're not of spirit stuff. You have to go deeper and higher within, above your feelings about the matter in the external world, to find spirit, to find your relationship to the universal Father that Jesus 2,000 years ago encouraged you to find. Right? And if you do that, what he tried to get you to do 2,000 years ago, you'll have a hold of genuine ideals. Oh, and coincidentally, as confused as we are, nonetheless, coming out of the Enlightenment, those 3 centuries of the Enlightenment, we did get the beginnings of some genuine science. It's all gotten corrupted in the 20th and 21st centuries, but we had it at the beginning of the 20th century when they gave us this. They said, okay, you've got science now. You have a way to begin to objectively get to facts instead of believing the figments of your imagination like you always have for a million years. And if you follow what Jesus told you to do, you can get a hold of genuine ideals, spiritual ideals. You now have the two components. You can put facts and ideals together, and you can get a super additive consequence that lifts you up into that objective, top-down vantage point of genuine philosophy, a genuine objective frame where you can now approach issues like race. Right? And you have to face the facts. Okay, we over the course of the 20th century and into the 21st, our challenge to face the facts has gotten mostly lost. It's now forbidden to face the facts of race. Right? All of the so-called best minds in our institutions say there is no such thing as race. That you're racist to even use the word race. No, there's race. It's not simplistic things like we think, but nonetheless there is. There's differences. And one of those differences we'll see coming up here, those 6 sangic races, the mind that you have has 7 phases. And each of those 6 sangic races, they have all 7 phases of mind, but each one of them favors one of the first 6 phases of mind. They're called adjutants in the book, mind adjutants. And then Adam and Eve's stock blends in. It favors the 7th phase. See, so the idea is that you have 6 races, each of them sort of leaning in and kind of maximizing the use of one of those 6 phases of mind. You bring them together and you have all 6 of those phases, kind of in full power. And then you put the cherry on the top with the 7th, which is the spirit of wisdom. Right? And that coordinates all of that mind together, and takes you up into the full use of your mind. I mean, so one of the facts about race is, even though we don't have these pure races, certain, we have various mixed races now. Certain mixed races will have different favoritisms of how they use mind. We all have the same mind, but we use it differently. I mean, females use mind differently than males. Okay, you can't even say that anymore. All right, let alone saying that secondary sangics use mind different than primary sangics, different than Northern European Andite sort of upstepped mind. Everyone has a different mode of mind, and you have to face that. You know, there's a lot more than skin color. You know, there's literal mind difference, and you have to face that fact and adjust that to ideals. You know, a false ideal that humans love now is that all men are born equal. No. Right? No, all men are created equal by a spiritual father, creator. You're spiritually equal. You're created equal, like our declaration says. In contrast to what the Europeans were believing when we founded the United States and continue to believe, that all men are born equal. No. For instance, there's males and females. Okay, there's that difference. But there's also races with different mind tendencies. Those are just facts. And no amount of delusional believing otherwise is going to change that. Right? Any more than the university professor telling you that there really isn't race, that the only reason there's light-skinned people is because as you walk to higher latitude, your skin gets lighter. No, that's not why my skin is light, because I walked north from the equator and my skin got lighter. Right? My skin is light because I have a lot of, you know, of that very fair-skinned Adamic stock that's washed out all my pigment. That's why my skin is light. So, you know, these are facts. We are physically different, inescapably. We are mentally, intellectually different, inescapably. But we're spiritually equal. Right? And can you do what Jesus said to actually love like the Father loves you? That spiritual father, where issues of matter and mind are irrelevant, right? I don't love you more because of your skin color or less because of your skin color. He loves you. He loves us absolutely. There's no relativity. There isn't anything that alters his love for us, right? You can, as long as you exist, you can be as horrendous can be imagined, or as saintly can imagine. It doesn't change his love for you one iota. He loves everyone absolutely the same. Right? It certainly makes no note of skin color. Right? Now, we love everyone because we engage in spirit. Love is a spirit word. We engage them spiritually and equally in love, but we don't falsely believe that they look exactly like we do or think the same way that we do.
So, you know, it's all very enlightening and interesting for all three of these people to watch them, but they all just left the church. And, you know, they're spectating on this for the first time, and what do you have to offer them? Why don't they go back to the church? What's so great about this book and what y'all doing here?
Well, the book is also, it's not, there's, it's an epical revelation, but it's not like the normal epical revelation on a world. Normally, an epical revelation inaugurates a new dispensation. It's called a dispensation, a whole new kind of order of things. And a dispensational epical revelation, like Jesus of Nazareth 2,000 years ago, is meant to be universalized. It's meant for everyone. And if the apostles hadn't corrupted it, if they hadn't brought in issues of matter and mind, they'd kept it spiritual, it would have been universalizable and would have been able to engage everyone as it was supposed to, as a dispensational revelation. This is not a dispensational revelation. It's not meant for everyone. I mean, just the fact that we're talking about race tonight kind of points that out. The book is filled with things that are not meant for a timid, faint flicker of faith. It doesn't blink in laying out facts in very stark fashion. I always say there's a warning up front. Warning, not for those timid souls. Okay. The book is here for those individuals who are ready to step out of sort of nothing but grace that every child of God, mere child of God, needs, and are ready to take on the challenge of moving into adolescence towards adulthood. Those who would like to become an adult of God. Adults have to face facts. So, see, when all is said and done, it's meant to engage those who are ready to take on the challenge of facing the full facts. They can overcome their fears. They can overcome their ideological biases they've been indoctrinated into. They can step up above all of that, all of their religious indoctrination, all their scientific indoctrination, all their whatever indoctrination, governmental, political. They can step up above all those isms, and they can become an objective seed in an ever-darkening philosophic domain. They can become leaders. There's an emergency. If it's not a dispensational epical revelation, it's an emergency epical revelation. This is an emergency epical revelation. The emergency is a philosophic emergency, a civilizational emergency. It's not a spiritual emergency. That was taken care of 2,000 years ago. It's not an individual emergency. You can take your salvation for granted now. So you're not in this crisis mode where you either get a hold of it and get a soul, or you're not going to survive this life. Okay, that's not. You get a soul by grace now. You'll go forward. Complete by grace, but you begin by grace. The emergency is a collective one. It's a philosophic one. It's a civilizational one. If there aren't a few leaders that can kind of get their cosmic consciousness back, and become stabilizing, properly directing influences in our world, civilization is going to collapse. And there's going to be a dark ages like mankind has never seen before. The 9 centuries of the Middle Ages will look like nothing. Okay, they tell you. There'll be an interregnum of cataclysmic proportions. Who knows how long it'll take us to come out of it. We'll lose everything. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. Okay? And that's the emergency. For we need those solid leaders. Our universities have been corrupted now by ignorant notions. We need to get people back to facing facts instead of delighting in their arbitrary beliefs. Because arbitrary beliefs and affirmations of those beliefs doesn't lead a civilization forward. Right? It leads it into darkness. And so that's the book. That's what the book. The book is here to give you the better set of initial assumptions. If you want to improve particle physics from the magical notions that it's believing in right now, it gives you what you need. If you want to improve ideas of government, if you want to get out of the magical notions that are being more and more believed, right? It gives you the basics. It gives you all of the basic frameworks. It doesn't carry everything through completely. It only gives you what we can't develop ourselves. It gives us that basic framework, and from it we can develop that better particle physics, that better paleontology, that better religion,
that better concept of God, that better concept of Jesus,
everything. We can take Jesus out of the shackles of the Jesusism that he's in right now. Right? I mean, Jesus didn't go about talking about himself. Jesus went about talking about his spiritual father, about God. Right? If you go about talking about Jesus, that's Jesusism.
All the apostles, for the most part, except the Alpheus twins, were killed, including Jesus and many others, countless others of the early Christians. Mm-hmm. Why is there no religious persecution in the Urantia movement? And when do you think the Urantia movement will come out of the closet?
We'll get back to this. Yeah, let's get back to the story here. But I'll give that one little last little, address that one last little issue. If you think about what I was just saying, about how there are very stark things, the facts are laid out very starkly in here. Everyone should be thankful that it's not universally recognized right now. Because we haven't done burning at the stake for a while, but it could come back. Some of the things that are said in here, but some of the things are so controversial, so politically incorrect. Okay. There was another emergency revelation, the third one. The third epical revelation was also an emergency one. This one's supposed to work the same way. There's a few things, the things that aren't so controversial, like John was just saying. Those things will kind of feed into the main evolutionary stream and improve it a little bit. Machiavelli and Melchizedek, 4,000 years ago, engaged Abraham and injected some slight improvements into the main evolutionary stream. But his main job was not that, any more than the main job of the fifth epical revelation is the main evolutionary stream. The main job is to establish a solid parallel stream of leaders, like the stream that Machiavelli and Melchizedek 4,000 years ago established in the Kenites. So you go forward a few centuries, and out of that stream can come a leader for the main evolutionary stream, Moses. Okay? He created a behind-the-scenes, not recorded in history, basically parallel evolutionary stream of leadership potential. Right? Of those who had a bigger sense of the world. And fundamentally, that's what this book should be doing too. It's not meant to be out there emblazoned in neon. Right? Most fundamentally. You can, as an individual, get clarified in your mind, like about who Jesus really was and whatnot, and find the genuine faith of Jesus like the apostles were supposed to find. You can find that genuine faith of Jesus. You can set down the book and you can go out into the world as a genuine apostle of the fourth epical revelation with the faith of Jesus embodied within you and illuminate the main evolutionary stream. You can do that. But you can also step out of the spotlight, right, and take on the fullness of it. And continue to have it in your lap and get together like this and engage issues of race thousands of years ago in Europe and whatnot, okay? And develop, this parallel stream can develop that can produce the nucleation, the nuclear individuals for civilization. And the book tells you there's never been more than 1% of individuals in any generation that have leadership potential. So it's not an emergency that there's less than 50% or something. Right? There's never been more than 1%. The emergency is you're about to lose that less than 1% of individuals who have any education or awakening to some sort of an objective consciousness. And you've got the blind leading the blind now. Right? Moses could lead the blind people of Israel because he wasn't blind. Okay? There has to be those that can lead again. Right, so that's the main reason. And so it has to talk about everything. It's got to talk about biology and geology and paleontology and everything you can think of, particle physics and everything, to give that full big picture. so that you can have these grounded, well-rounded individuals. The nations of the world all have citizens by some definition. The leaders need to be more than those, however defined, civic citizens. The leaders need to be first cosmic citizens. Right? Jesus told us 2,000 years ago that you're a child of a heavenly Father. Okay? This tells you that you can be, if you take delight in cultivating, you can be a cosmic citizen. You can take a hold of your cosmic heritage, more than your spiritual heritage, like he was encouraging you to take a hold of. You can take a hold of your cosmic heritage. You can take your material consciousness on the one hand and your spiritual consciousness on the other hand, and you can put them together and get a super additive consequence of cosmic consciousness, philosophic consciousness. You can see, embody the big picture, and you can lead others. Yeah. Out of this civilizational darkness.
May I read a quote from part four?
Well, let's get back to this. We don't want to go too far. We want to get a little bit more into this tonight here before, so we don't go too astray.
John.
But you got a question, John?
It's more on the
DRAM. Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay. It's not like we don't, often, when whatever we're reading, we take these little sidetracks. What's happening here tonight is not atypical. Those who are here all the time know this. We often do this because it's important to do it. You know, you can get lost in a lot of the details as you're going through various parts of the book. So it's important occasionally to take some time and remind yourself of why you're doing this. Why am I studying what was happening, in prehistorical Europe? Why am I doing that? Right, but it, and just as words on a page, it's always boring, because words cannot convey truth. Words are not truth cannot be defined with words. Right, we're trying. You have to keep that big picture in play as you're engaging the words, so that you can begin to find the truth that's flowing through the words. And the big truth that we see so often immediately is there, no matter what you're reading about. You're reading something in the Jesus papers about what was going on in Capernaum, or you're reading about what's going on in ancient Europe. So often you go, oh, and that's not happening, so that's going to lead to a collapse of civilization. Over and over again, no matter where you are in the book. Right? They're trying to point out the basic things that are being lost that inescapably lead to the collapse of civilization. Okay.
And in the first parts of the book more, they're trying to teach you a lot about what's, really who God is, which we have a very paltry understanding.
Who God is, what the cosmos is.
A father and son, what's behind it all, or what's, how it all started, where is it all from? And then you learn, oh my gosh, we're from the most backward planet in the entire universe. Oh gosh, we think it's great.
Well, not the most backward, but close to it.
Second most backward. And they say that they envy you. What? They envy you because you get to start at the bottom. You get to start at the bottom. And the reason Jesus came here, he's the creator of our entire universe. He came here because we are in trouble. Because we were, his lost sheep, so to speak.
Jesus.
And that's what he does. Came here to rescue us, I would say. And when you realize who Jesus really is, before he got here today, you go, oh my gosh.
Well, he's creator of our local universe.
Right.
a small part of a much bigger picture. He's the creator, basically what you see in the night sky with your naked eyes. All right. So back to didn't we just finish the one where it's they very naturally chose union with the blue race as Europe? Is that where we were? No. We read the next. Oh yeah, we read the next one. Okay, so we're at slowly, yeah, okay. All right, so that was a big sidetrack. So we have them all trying to, there was one little thing kind of gets back again. when it said that you had the blue man entertain the ambition of becoming so skillful and artistic as to win the affection of some Adamite woman, there you're seeing which adjutant he favors, right? He favors the fifth adjutant, or the fourth adjutant. I'm having a hard time with my sangiks and adjutants tonight. Okay. He favors the fourth adjutant, right? The spirit of knowledge. Right? So he has an immediacy toward technical skill, tool making, things like that. You know, he favors that. Right? That whole see skillful, right? His individuality consciousness, you know, doing things very precisely, and just, you can't do art if your mind is just all fuzzed out, right? You have to be able to, bring to a focus. There's a lot of technical things, how do you make pigments for paints, and what kind of chisels do you need, to work with marble, and right, there's a lot of tool stuff and science stuff and technical stuff, right? So that spirit of knowledge, that fourth adjutant, right, he's favoring. So see, he's trying to present the best of what they're naturally best at and hope it impresses.
Photoshop.
Yeah, look at me. All right, so that's what's going on there. You're seeing their favoritism of the fourth adjutant coming out there.
Slowly, these migrating sons of Eden united with the higher types of the blue race, invigorating their cultural practices while ruthlessly exterminating the lingering strains of Neanderthal stock. This technique of race blending, combined with the elimination of inferior strains, produced a dozen or more virile and progressive groups of superior blue men, one of which you have denominated the Cro-Magnons.
All right, you can say Cro-Magnon, or you can say Cro-Magnon, if you want to say it more French. If you know anything, any anthropology, go, oh, wait a minute, I've heard that before. All right, so that's what we're building up to. So, notice what you have between the lines there. Like I said, 300,000 years ago, blue man, relatively pure blue man, went in there and mated with the better Neanderthal strains, exterminated some, but obviously not whole scale. Right? There's still a lot of inferior back-mated strains and stuff there. It's only when you get this initial juicing, this additional energizing, with that Adamic stock, you have more zeal in play and more foresight in play. And it's like, okay, let's just fix this problem right now, period. Let's just exterminate every inferior individual, period, end of story. So they cleaned up the domain so that, it ends up being like the Far East was, right? Without any of this, it's not going to be any more of this dragging things down genetically because of inferior stocks. Once you get this Adamic sensibility in there a little bit, they clean house.
And they didn't do this philosophically, right? I mean, they didn't do it premeditatively, right? Scott, what do you think? I think it was done like, sit around and plan and work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's totally planned. These are inferiors, we're going to kill them all. I mean, remember that? That's how you got that original 850,000 years ago, original Neanderthal stock is, those Andonites, those better Andonites saying, okay, this is getting out of control. They have enough foresight to see the writing on the wall. It's like, if we let this go, it's all going to just disappear. So they just exterminated all the inferiors as far as the eye could see in every direction and reconstituted the nucleus of the Andonic stock. That's the only way to do it because, like I said, I mean, nature is nature. Eventually, you start mating with things you shouldn't mate with. right? And so the only way to solve it, right, is to just get rid of them. So Europe was finally cleaned up, and you had those. You blended in a little Adamic blood, But you notice, see, they're basically still calling them blue men. You have blue men coming from Central Asia. They blend in with some of the better Neanderthals, and you're still calling them blue men. You have a little bit of Adamic blood blended in. They're still calling them blue men. See, it's all minimal. They're still basically blue men, but they're modified blue men. Okay? And when you have that sort of kind of this full modifications, this sort of pre-Andite blue man, that's what those Cro-Magnons and those like them are like, those tribes in Europe. That's what those peoples represent. You know, and you look up, well, where did they start? Oh, they started being in Europe right in the wake of Adam and Eve. Yes, of course they did, because it wasn't until you had the Adamites going in there that you had that upstepped blue man. And that's why those Cro-Magnons appear seemingly out of nowhere in Europe back around then. Right? You know, somewhere in the, 37,000, years ago or range or whatever. Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's what the Cro-Magnons and those like them are all about. That's what we're getting to. And so now, see, now you're going to have, it's those Cro-Magnon-like peoples that are ready for eventual upstepping by Andite. You know, in contrast to the yellow man, getting upstepped by Andite. This is what we have, sort of pre-Andite, is this Cro-Magnon-like stock. All right. I got everything there? I think we got, let's keep going.
For these and other reasons, not the least of which was more favorable paths of migration, the early waves of Mesopotamian culture made their way almost exclusively to Europe, and it was these circumstances that determined the antecedents of modern European civilization.
Okay, so you can see, they kind of came back around to the way they started. Okay, that's what this is all about. We're trying to figure out what kind of a genetic stock, dealing with nature first, we can deal with nurture second. But what nature is behind European civilization? What nature is behind Western civilization? Okay. All right. Let's. I think we have time to do this one little section here. We can get a little of these details about the climatic and geologic issues here.
Section 2, climatic and geologic changes. The early expansion of the violet race into Europe was cut short by certain rather sudden climatic and geologic changes. With the retreat of the northern ice fields, the water-laden winds from the west shifted to the north, gradually turning the great open pasture regions of Sahara into a barren desert. This drought dispersed the smaller statured brunettes, dark-eyed but long-headed dwellers of the Great Sahara Plateau.
Okay, at the very end there, see, not only do they have black hair and black eyes, remember that's what brunette, literally means. It doesn't mean brown hair. I mean, it's referring to, black-haired people. And, of course, it's kind of coming out of Europe. It's those southern Europeans. They're being called brunettes. So black hair, black eye. But these secondary Sangiks, the Saharan peoples there, they're medium to long-headed. So they're bringing in that. Those peoples can go into southern Europe, and you're still going to have kind of a long-headed people in Europe, see, from that, Adamic nature, is not going to be altered, in that head shape way. Other ways, obviously, yes, but not in the simple head shape way. Oh, and just a little aside, since we're talking about the whole head shape fixation and how silly it was with the Nazis and stuff. If you want to get a better assessment of what racial stock is in an individual, And they tell you, you should look at the whole body, not just the skull. And one of the things that you definitely have, if you look at the whole body, if the features of the body, you don't have to be fat at all, but if just the features of the body are more rounded, you know, the curves are smoother, you know, that's a basic Sangic evolutionary stock. To get the more angular features, you know, not just in the face, but in the body in general, that's coming from Adamic blood, is what gives them more angular features to bodies. Our evolutionary stock is quite rounded in nature. And you can really see that if you look at a whole body, if you don't just look at someone's head.
Climate change.
Okay. Yeah, so we've got lots of, like I've said before, we've got lots of significant geologic changes and lots of significant climatic changes. It's sudden relative to thousands and thousands and thousands of years. What's setting this sudden change of affairs up is, remember, the ice age after 2 million years is basically coming to an end. As they tell you, effectively it was over 35,000 years ago. So you have, remember, the Mediterranean is going to fill up about 34,000 years ago. So 1,000 years before that, the ice age, except for ice at the poles, you know, it come to an end. And so everything was shifting because of that. And very significantly here, instead of having these winds bringing moisture in, right, from the west, things shift to the north, and the Sahara turns into a desert. Okay, Central Sahara, you know, gets basically zero rain, right? You know, so that's what's happening, and so you have a little bit before we have all the cataclysm in the Mediterranean, you're already gonna start to turn the Sahara, into a desert. All right, so that's what we're setting up here. And we'll get into some of the geologic changes a little bit here, too, in a minute.
The pure indigo elements moved southward to the forests of Central Africa, where they have ever since remained. The more mixed groups spread out in three directions. The superior tribes to the west migrated to Spain and thence to adjacent parts of Europe, forming the nucleus of the later Mediterranean long-headed brunette races. The least progressive division to the east of the Sahara Plateau migrated to Arabia and thence through northern Mesopotamia and India to faraway Ceylon. The central group moved north and east to the Nile Valley and into Palestine.
Okay, so all those peoples that were in northern Africa there, remember how they mentioned it was an indigo black people. You got a lot of indigo, and you've got some of those indigo that came in the end didn't really blend in, and you know, to any great degree. And as you go red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, the mean height of the people decreases. Indigo is the shortest stature, so that's why when you take, like they say, the pure indigo elements, when they get pushed south, that's why you have like pygmies, okay? You have a lot of very short people because it's, you know, there isn't other stock of higher, taller stature blended in to any degree. So you can get some very short peoples down there in Central Africa.
Plus some really tall ones, too.
Okay, the really tall ones, remember, is because Orange Man and Green Man had giant strains. I mean, you literally had some giants in Orange Man and Green Man that were 9 foot tall. And so you can shorten that quite a bit with indigo, and you still have people that are all 7 foot tall. Basketball players, right? That's where those very tall Africans come from, is those giant strains in Orange Man and Green Man. shortened a little bit by indigo. Okay, but so you can tell that, you know, all that migration of the secondary Sangiks into Africa, they were still kind of just hanging in that wonderful, pleasant place in the north. And it's not until relatively recently that, you know, people get pushed further south to any great degree. Okay, and then you've got the more mixed peoples. You know, like I said, they break into three groups, and the first group is what's going to get blended into Southern Europe to give you that basic differential between, you know, Northern Europeans and Southern Europeans. You know, and that olive skin and the brunette hair and, you know, and stuff, you know, in you know, Italy, say. See, and those are going, remember, it's you can go across the Strait of Gibraltar, that's hasn't broken. So like they're saying there, they migrate across the, you know, that bridge there at the Strait of Gibraltar into Spain and then spread eastward across Southern Europe. And that gives you that variation in Southern Europe. You literally have, you know, the when they talk about the Sahara Plateau, that's the higher region in the center of the Sahara there. So you got some of those that literally get shoved all the way over into that catch basin of India and all the way down to, you know, what's now Sri Lanka, Ceylon. So that's explaining kind of, you know, what's going on there. And then the central group here, see, moved north. Okay, so some of them did go into Southern Europe across the Sicilian land bridge. You know, that's how they can go north, right? And then some of them went east into the Nile Valley and into Palestine. And we saw before them talking about them flooding into the Nile Valley and kind of bringing all of that, you know, civilization down there to a minimum, and it's going to bounce back up again. Okay, so the funny thing about this is, you know, we know what literally is the case, that humans originated in Central Asia. And all, you know, they spread to the four corners of the earth from Central Asia. It's out of Central Asia. But current science, you know, ever since the Leakeys found skeletons and ancient skeletons in Africa, you know, everything has gotten re-rationalized. So everyone believes it's all out of Africa. You know, every theory now is out of Africa theories. And they believe in multiple out of Africa ways to rationalize everything. Well, there was an out of Africa event. Not many. And not long ago, but one, there was one basic out of Africa event right here, right? And it went all the way over to Ceylon and whatnot. The only other out of Africa is some of those, you know, some of those Australopithecines and whatnot skeletons that we've found in Africa. Those are those near-human stocks that went up into Europe that the Neanderthals were backmating with. That's the only other out of Africa, are those subhuman strains. But here's actual human strains, you know, an actual out of Africa event. So that's kind of a funny between the lines there. Okay, everything else there? Yeah, let's get some more here.
It is this secondary Sangic substratum that suggests a certain degree of kinship among the modern peoples scattered from the Deccan through Iran, Mesopotamia, and along both shores of the Mediterranean Sea.
So, like I said, that the degree to which you can see this commonality and rationalize it as out of Africa, that's validly rationalized as out of Africa. You know, all the way from the Deccan over there in the Indian subcontinent, you know, through Southern Europe. All right.
About the time of these climatic changes in Africa, England separated from the continent and Denmark arose from the sea, while the Isthmus of Gibraltar, protecting the western basin of the Mediterranean, gave way as the result of an earthquake, quickly raising this inland lake the level of the Atlantic Ocean. Presently, the Sicilian land bridge submerged, creating one sea of the Mediterranean and connecting it with the Atlantic Ocean. This cataclysm of nature flooded scores of human settlements and occasioned the greatest loss of life by flood in all the world's history.
Okay, so there was a quote-unquote great flood. It was about 34,000 years ago when the Mediterranean, in very short order, right, so you can just imagine an earthquake breaks that, and so it just comes pouring in from the Atlantic.
No time to get out of the way.
All these wonderful settlements that they had around those lakes, right, it's all just washed away. And so there's a massive loss of life, you know, and you know, closeness to Mesopotamia, you know, a lot of it was, you know, relatively high quality life too, genetically. It was lost in a vast submergence there.
How did England separate?
Okay, yeah, so yeah, I was going to get to that stuff. So yeah, so the, you know, the bulk of that is what we've been talking about. See, that's where they finally kind of give the details of how that all came to pass with the Strait of Gibraltar and the Sicilian land bridge. Now, these climatic changes, okay, like just over the last 2 million years with the ice age, you know, the ice age and its cycles, right? I mean, climate has been all over the map, right? You know, from that, you know, pushing humans all over the place. You know, and changing everything, you know, about every 1,000 years, you know, everything would get totally erased. You know, what was a great place to live became a terrible place to live, and vice versa. You know, it was very, very variable for a long, long time. You have this sort of final issue as that sixth wave of ice retreated. You know, and was basically retreated at 35,000 years ago. Right. Lots and lots and lots of massive continental ice sheets are melting, right, as that's retreating. So the ocean is going up and up and up. Okay, we worry right now about, you know, rising oceans. Okay, nothing is ever going to happen like happened, you know, just in those recent times. Right, I mean, the ocean went up between 400 and 500 feet. Okay, as the ice was melting. Okay, and we're worried about a few centimeters right now. Okay, 500 feet. Okay, the oceans are going up as all that ice melts. Think about all the wonderful places to live that went underwater, like all those islands out in the Pacific that disappeared. Right, the ocean goes up 500 feet. Lots of islands are going to disappear in the Pacific, right? Those oceans have gone way up. You know, in this little isthmus of Gibraltar, and it breaks, and so you basically the full thing. You'll see flooding in, and all that, the wind changes, like they said. So all this stuff, everything is getting shifted. You know, we talked about in Central Asia and in farther Asia, you know, all of the things that used to be wonderful places to live, you know, were turned into deserts, the Gobi Desert and Taklamakan Desert and whatnot. You know, and I have the Sahara Desert. All, you have all these winds are shifting and stuff. So
England separated.
Okay. So now those other two little things they throw in there, besides the basics of like with the Mediterranean and the ocean rising from all the ice melting, they mention a couple other things. Well, the first one you can go, well, England separated from the continent. Okay. In other words, probably the main reason is the ocean goes up, you know, hundreds of feet. Okay, you're gonna fill the English Channel. That's basically what happened, right? That's just a matter of the ocean rising that England gets separated from the mainland. And an awful lot of that area, you know, is pretty shallow up in there, right? Used to be a lot more land up in there until the oceans went up all that, you know, that huge amount. But the other thing is, it's like, wait a minute, and Denmark arose from the sea? Wait a minute, I thought the ocean's going up, and so everything's going under the sea. Why is Jutland, you know, as we're talking about Denmark, we're talking about Jutland rising from the sea. Okay, well, when the ice melts, all those huge continental ice sheets melt, yeah, okay, the water goes in the ocean, and the ocean rises. Okay, but here in North America, down in North Dakota at the front of the continental ice sheet, you know, that front face of the ice was a mile high, right? A mile thick sheet of ice is a lot of weight crushing down on the land. You melt that ice and the land rebounds. All of Northern Europe is still rising because you've taken that load off of it from the ice. It's still rising many millimeters a year. As a matter of fact, right, if you take the average of what the ocean is rising right now, that's maybe like a little more than 3 millimeters a year. I mean, some parts of Northern Europe, the land is rising 3 times faster than that. So it's not going to go underwater because the ocean is rising. The land's rising faster. Not to mention something you don't, you know, hear them talk about. If you put more water in the ocean, that pushes down on the seafloor, which pushes the continents up.
Most of my flowers
drop. Well, that's a sandbar. It's probably not going to push the sandbar up. You shouldn't build on sandbars. Okay, but obviously between the lines here, you know, there's a lot of things trying to get us more objective about issues of changes in climate. Right, I mean, eventually there will be no ice in the North and South Poles because eventually the ice age will be over. You know, there are no ice ages in the era of light and life. Right? There's no ice on Gerasim. There's no ice on a Havona world. Okay.
Eventually,
all that, right, there'll be different temperatures because of continents and continental climate, but right, there won't be any ice eventually. So it's going to melt one way or another. But anyway, you know, most of it's already melted. The ocean's not going to go up another 500 feet. And you have all this rebound, you know. Think about how much Canada is still rising. Right, all that ice is off of it. Stuff like that. Okay. All right. So that's the base. You have all these changes. I mean, you know, most of Finland used to be under the water until it rose up out of the water. You know, stuff like that. Okay. All right.
This engulfment of the Mediterranean basin immediately curtailed the westward movements of the Adamites, while the great influx of Saharans led them to seek outlets for their increasing numbers to the north and east of Eden. As the descendants of Adam journeyed northward from the valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates, they encountered mountainous barriers and the then expanded Caspian Sea. And for many generations, the Adamites hunted, herded, and tilled the soil around their settlements scattered throughout Turkestan. Slowly, this magnificent people extended their territory into Europe. But now the Adamites enter Europe from the east and find the culture of the blue man thousands of years behind that of Asia, since this region has been almost entirely out of touch with Mesopotamia.
Again, you know, I mean, they're reminding you that why Adam and Eve come. I mean, you can't have civilization without the Adamic uplift. And even though you fed in those almost 4,000 years there, you fed some into Europe, and you got Cro-Magnon-like peoples, and improved people, they get cut off, and so the culture decays there with time. And you know, here we're seeing, you know, so once you're past, you know, about 34,000 years ago when the Mediterranean filled up and all this stuff happened, like they're saying, then it kind of moves in that mode that we talked about so much, You know, where basically you have the Mesopotamians drifting northeast into Central Asia, into Turkestan, and the whole story that we've been reading about plays out to the east. But now we're going to pick up, you know, the story of those that they mentioned that went from Central Asia there up around, eventually up around the Caspian Sea and into Northern Europe. Okay? You know, and so they're going to enter Northern Europe, and that all that Andite stuff is going to trickle, you know, sort of blend to the south. So even when you bring in all of that Andite, it's not going to filter down south enough to completely swamp and submerge all of the Saharan peoples that moved into Southern Europe, like we just read. So you're definitely going to end up with a differential between Northern and Southern Europe because of the genetic difference. The only question we haven't figured out is, what about the central white race? What made it so that there's not just two white races in Europe, but three? We'll eventually get to that story, you know, what happened there. But you can see you've got this conspiracy of climate and geography, geology, if you will, that makes it so those early Cro-Magnon-like peoples kind of get isolated again. And they aren't genetically deteriorating now because you eliminated all the inferior stock. But they're going to culturally, you know, decline until you can get some individuals that are a little bit more of a people of the future and have a little bit more of a directional consciousness and more Adamic blood and can reinvigorate those people and get them kind of leaning forward into the future again. They're kind of just, you know, falling back and stagnating for a while there. All right, so that's where we'll pick it up next time. Some more of the details about how it plays out in Europe. You know, you can see that not only did they mention issues of climate over and over and over again earlier in the book, but they devote a whole section to it here just to stress this. And again, this is what, you know, just take a second here to remind you, the important point about this section is not so that you know about changes in the climate way back 34,000 years ago. Right. The point, what's the truth? You know, those are the facts of the paragraph. The truth that's flowing through the paragraph is climate changes. Right? I mean, not only will there be lots of natural changes between now and the era of light and life, but remember how they tell you get to the fifth stage of light and life on a world, and the master physical controllers take control of a planet, and everything's going to change then. They'll completely alter the entire topography of the planet and everything. I mean, we have to stop existentializing the arrangement of molecules on the planet. There's nothing sacred about some sandbar in the southeastern United States or something. Unless you live on it and are falsely existentializing it and wanting it to be, you know, one of the Havona worlds and part of eternity. Right, there's nothing that's part of eternity in the arrangement of molecules on this planet. We have to stop thinking like this. See, you're applying your ideals to matter, and that's false. That's material idealism. Right? 2,000 years ago, Jesus tried to explain to you to stop doing that. Stop existentializing the arrangement of molecules. Stop thinking of a certain arrangement of molecules as sacred. Right? And divine and eternal and absolute and whatnot, right? Everything changes out there and will continue to change, you know, a long, long time to come. You know, billions, trillions of years into the future is going to be changing. Okay, apply your notion of ideals to literal spirit stuff, spirit substance, spirit fact. And take your ideals beyond a notion. Make them genuine spiritual ideals. Ideas are about matter. Ideals are about spirit. And whenever you apply your religious impulse, your sixth adjutant, to ideas about matter, you form an ideology, an ism. To do what Jesus told you to do 2,000 years ago, you have to stop doing that. You have to transcend isms, no matter what ism it is. You know, Republicanism, Democratism, positivism, progressivism, you know, secularism, humanism, whatever the heck it, Mohammedanism, Buddhism, whatever ism it is, Jesusism. You have to stop doing that.
Longheadism.
Longheadism, right? Whatever ism it is, you've got to let go of all those isms. Transcend it. That's what this book is here to try to encourage you to do. To apply ideals to genuine spirit, to initiate the process, and then go from there and find wisdom, find genuine philosophy, find the objective framework so that civilization doesn't collapse. All right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.